Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. Now tonight, it's my pleasure to welcome the comedic novelist Pam Furtubar. She was born and raised in Wisconsin, the only child of two loving but quirky parents who fostered her creativity by setting a place at the table for her imaginary friend Daka and preparing his favorite invisible food, Mugger. After graduating from Marquette University with a BS in journalism, Pam worked at Furtubar Studios, the family advertising photography business, where she honed her skills as a TV commercials director and was paid to play with imaginary friends called actors. In 1994, she moved to Los Angeles, where she directed commercials for Microsoft, Wells Fargo Bank, Bally's, ITT, and others, and in her spare time wrote screenplays such as Bob Dylan Stole My Wife, for which she is currently seeking financing for a Wisconsin-based production. In 1998, she wrote the novella Feng Shui and Charlotte Nightingale, sparking a bidding war for the movie rights. New Line Cinema purchased the rights in a record-breaking $800,000 deal, and a few months later, all the executives on the project were fired, and Pam's movie was shelved. That was a classic Charlotte moment. As Charlotte would say, it wasn't my fault. After completing a novel based on the novella Feng Shui and Charlotte Nightingale, Pam returned to Wisconsin in 2013. Her father, Tom Furtubar, a student of the great Ansel Adams and a master photographer himself, tutors Pam in the art of photography. Pam is working on a second Charlotte Nightingale novel and a companion book with readers, Charlotte moments, complemented with illustrations and Pam's own photographs. Pam and her friend Daka continue to play and eat Mugger. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, Pam. You let me know. Okay. I love it.
It probably doesn't matter.
Tell us how Daka came into being for you when you first realized that you had this friend.
I don't know exactly when that happened, but my parents tell me it was around the time I was 3 years old that I started talking about him.
Uh-huh.
And he was around until I was in grade school for a while. I was around adults all the time. I'm an only child. We lived with my grandmother. There were not a lot of little kids in the neighborhood, and I suppose Daka was just a way to have a playmate who wasn't an adult, so I could be, I don't know, silly, stupid, you know, whatever. But as we were saying just before the show, I mean, I don't remember when he, like, I don't remember waking up one day and going, oh, my gosh, who is this fuzzy thing? But I remember him so vividly, how he looked in my mind's eye. He was so real that to this day I could draw you a picture. He was like a brown penguin with no arms, just kind of flat, fuzzy feet, and he had two big brown eyes and like a sweet little bow mouth. And I don't remember him having ears or anything. He kind of looked like Cousin It, frankly, across the street. And a brown penguin, but he was my best friend. And my parents were very indulgent. They would set a place for him at the table. My mother would cook this invisible food, Mugger, which I think was probably, as I recall, it was a gruel. And when you grew up in Wisconsin in the really cold winters, you know, you ate a lot of cream of wheat. and farina and oatmeal and stuff in the winter, and which I hated. And so it was very interesting that Daca loved it. So, yeah.
Well, what kind of interactions did you have with him?
We did everything together. He had to be tucked in with me at night. I remember mm-hmm. him helping me choose what I was going to wear. It was like having your own Tim Gunn kind of hanging around in the house. We played games together. He kept me company. He kept me
company.
Did he
go to school with you?
That I don't remember, David. I don't remember if he did or not.
Yeah. Were there other adults that were aware of him and that indulged you in your imaginary friend?
I'm sure there were those. I'm sure everyone was aware of it. I mean, I'm sure my parents probably thought, is this normal? You know, I mean, there's something wrong with our daughter. She's 17. She has an invisible friend. But I don't remember any other adults. I don't remember anyone else, like, you know, making a place for him at the table or acknowledging him. It might have just been our little secret. I'm not sure.
Well, that's all right. We're all entitled to our secrets.
Yeah, kind of a wacky kid. Mm-hmm.
Well, so you write a comedic, along the comedic vein. What bearing did Daca have on your decision to become a writer and to write the kind of books that you've written?
Well, I don't know if it's a chicken or the egg. Like, Daca may well have been the manifestation of my first desire to tell stories, make stuff up, you know? And
mm-hmm.
I really think that because he's so vivid in my mind's eye, I mean, like a real person that you remember, you know, that you could identify if you had to, what I hear consistently, comments about my style of writing is that it's very descriptive, cinematic, you know, in that, wow, you can really see these scenes and exactly how this stuff looks. And I suspect that was probably always inside of me, and Daca was my first writing, I guess, in a way, before I knew how to write. So, he just, it's such a vivid thing. And now when I write and I laugh, and I know it sounds flippant and I don't mean it to be, but when I'm in the zone and I'm really writing, the characters are there and they're telling me what they want to say and do and all that because they seem so real to me. I'm probably not all there, David. It's what, when I hear myself.
Well,
famous,
who is and who wants to be? I mean, what's the fun of that?
Oh, good. I'll see you at the meeting.
Have you ever thought about writing a book about Daca for children?
No. You know what? That's a great idea. Oh. Well, our work here is finished.
No, it's not.
No.
But I mean, it seems like it would be a natural segue for you. I mean, you see him so vividly, and he was such a part of your life, and I think children would be delighted in a story about a little girl and her imaginary friend.
Yeah, and it's, you know, those are the things, it's just, I've never thought of that, but those are the things I love to write, are the things that are so, you know, every so often I get an assignment for something and I struggle because it's not coming to life for me. I have to find some way of putting flesh and bones on it. But this would be such a joy because he's the little guy is always with me. Oh, that's the best idea ever. Thank you.
Wow, I'm glad I planted a seed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, tell me about your book, Feng Shui and Charlotte Nightingale. What's it about?
It is about, on the face of it, a woman, young woman, with the worst luck in the world. she happens to be the poster child for bad feng shui. So her apartment, everything in her life is a wreck. You know, there's clutter, dead plants, the plumbing doesn't work properly, so she's got water issues, overhead beams that are painted black. You know, just everything you're not supposed to have for the positive flow of good energy through your space. And the Chinese food delivery man, Quan, who is feng shui master, aspiring feng shui master on the side, delivers some food one evening, and of course he shudders when she opens the door. But something about her is so pathetic and just touches him that he starts coming back, bringing her food that she didn't even order, just to give him the opportunity to do a little feng shui on the sly. And she's so beaten down by life, after a while she doesn't even argue with him anymore when she says, "I didn't order this food." And she disappears into the closet to try to excavate her old purses and jacket pockets, because, of course, she's always broke. So she's trying to, you know, find quarters and nickels and dimes so she can pay him. And while she's in there doing that, he kind of sneaks in and just does a little feng shui to see if he can't improve her life a little bit. And it has the result. It appears to have the result of her making her luck go from bad to worse. And she doesn't just have a boyfriend who borrows, in quotes, her rent money, but she finds a Polaroid of her boyfriend with a stripper under her bed that was taken in her bed, begs the question, who took the picture? And later when she calls him on it, he said, her boyfriend Joey, he goes, "I never touched the sister." So she just, everything seems to get worse and worse and worse. But it ends, you know, it's like with anything in life, it's a matter of perspective. And she really needed to find out. It was a positive thing, actually, to find out that her boyfriend was, you know, a cheating louse. And she has the world's worst job, and then she's fired from it. Well, you know, in her mind, because she's always looking at the glass as half empty, oh, you know, my God, I've lost my job. When really, you know, thank God you lost your job, because it was a dead-end job, it was soul-sucking, and you needed that to happen. And so as the story progresses, and she ends up on a tremendous adventure, which the reader, you know, that can decide for him or herself, is this all driven by the feng shui, or is it just that someone stepped into her life and tried to do something kind for her, and that kind of tipped the scales a little bit where she started to feel some self-confidence and some self-worth? Or did she literally just wake up one day and say, "I've had enough of this now. You know, people are going to stop walking all over me"? Or was it a combination of all the above? Because what ends up happening is she, you know, the minute you start feeling better about yourself and you change your perspective, hey, that glass is half full, it's not half empty, what happens? Things start to turn around for you. Perhaps not in the way that you exactly thought you wanted or needed, but your life changes as soon as your perspective changes. And that I do believe. And I don't know whether I believe it's the result of prayer, magic, feng shui, voodoo, mitzvah, all that stuff, or if it's when people are kind to you, does that somehow change something inside of you and you see yourself in a different light, you behave differently so you attract different things? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I love the question. So hopefully, and the book is hilarious. I mean, it really is like a screwball comedy. So, you know, it's not like a great deep thinking stuff, but I've been doing a lot of book clubs, Skyping them all over the country, and the coolest thing is the deeper message that people are finding in the book. You know, the publisher kind of was, oh, you know, this is a romp. This is going to be a great summer read. And I was okay with that. You know, I mean, as long as it's entertaining and it makes people happy. But it does my soul such good when I hear over and over and over that it really means something to people, and that when they're at a low point and they read this, it made them feel better about themselves and they made a few changes in their life. And I love that. I absolutely love that. And I think if you can do that with humor, man, that's the best.
Oh, I agree. I totally agree because I write humor books. So
I did my research too.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, what possessed you to write a humor book?
If I was going to write anything, pretty much almost everything I write is funny. You know, I just have that kind of, I just find humor in pretty much everything, which can be really disconcerting to some people. But I was living in L.A. and I was not in a great place in a marriage and whatever, and was watching the news one night. And there was a feature story about feng shui and how all of these huge corporations were hiring feng shui practitioners, Sony Pictures, Disney, you know, Kaiser Permanente, the healthcare giant. And I thought, wow, you know, what is this all about? And I started, you know, doing a ton of research. And it was just, I was kind of living and breathing it. It was, somehow it had gotten into my blood. And I woke up one night in the middle of the night, and again, it's going to sound so hokey and, you know, I'm sure people roll their eyes, but I felt this person, like Daka, only it was Charlotte. And she said, get up, get up, get up. Man, do I have a story for you. And I still get kind of choked up when I think about it because I needed an invisible friend right then and there. And what a great friend she turned out to be. A person who just doesn't take herself too seriously, kind of takes it on the chin all the time. So I started playing with Charlotte, and I wrote the novella in about 6 days. I think it was maybe 12, 14 pages, something like that. Spent a couple more weeks and expanded it to 40-some-odd pages. And then, as they say, all hell broke loose. There was a bidding war over the film rights, and it was all pretty exciting.
I bet.
Yeah, and then it wasn't. It was up. And then
yeah,
it was
whatever happened?
Well, you know, AOL and Time Warner merged, and I forget which one had owned New Line, but all the executives on the project were fired, and all the new people came in, and that's just the way of the world. You know, they brought their own projects in with them. They didn't want to be saddled with someone else's stuff, and that just kind of killed Charlotte. But interestingly enough, shortly before moving back to Wisconsin, I decided to write it as a full-length novel because they paid so much money for it. I told myself it's because it's a great idea, you know, and the executive saw something in there. And I wrote it as the novel and then sold my house and packed up and came back here and thought, oh yeah, there's that novel. I should do something with that. And I saw an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a local publisher who mostly publishes self-help books but selects one or two titles a year in fiction that she kind of really throws herself behind. And I thought, well, what the heck? You know, I'm going to send her a query letter, email her. And by the end of the week, she'd made an offer, and she loved it. So now it's a book. And now I'm getting some interest, and New Line has been getting quite a few calls, some people wanting to know what the status of it is. So, you know, I'm probably the world's biggest optimist, you know, like a big old jackass. I'm hoping that, you know, it'll get resurrected because it's, I don't know. It changed my life, playing with Charlotte and kind of watching her by example and how she went from everything being dark and glum and pessimistic and bad to, you know, throwing her shoulders back and saying, whatever comes next, I'm ready. And it just feels like right now in particular, that would be a really, really enjoyable thing to see. So.
Oh, that's yeah. Wouldn't that be satisfying?
Yes, well, that is my story, and I'm sticking to it because...
I don't blame you. I would, too.
Right?
Well, people that don't know what feng shui is, I mean, you've alluded to it, but can you clarify that?
Sure. It's an ancient. I believe the Chinese have been practicing feng shui for 4,000 or 5,000 years. It's basically the art of placement. And much as with our bodies, you know, if everything isn't unobstructed and clear and open, so that things can flow through us, and that's kind of what health is, you know, the oxygenation and, you know, all of our organs working properly, feng shui is the same thing when it comes to spatial relations. So the best example, I guess, is, you know, you walk into, say, someone's home and you immediately feel comfortable, right? You just feel loved and happy and content, and you could sit down and have a glass of wine and stay there forever. That's because the feng shui is excellent. There's energy moving properly through the room. There's nothing that's making you feel anxious or uncomfortable. And yet, you know, we've all walked into places, a doctor's office or someone's home or a shop, and you just, you just can't wait to get out of there. You know, you just feel, it gives you the heebie-jeebies. And I guarantee you it's because they've broken some of the rules of feng shui, and stuff makes you, it's like an oppressive feeling, or you get a little claustrophobic, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be a small space. So there's the common sense side of it where you just, there's a good flow in this space. And then there's all like the cool minutiae, charming, as I call it. I'm sure that would terrify or horrify real feng shui practitioners, but the charming stuff, which is, you know, the hanging of the Chinese coins that are tied together with the red silk, and then the eternity knots in between, that placed in the right sector of your house or your abode, is supposed to bring you wealth. And then there's all kinds of stuff you can do for love feng shui. And it just goes on and on and on. I mean, if you're looking for love, there's a special kind of feng shui. If you're already in a relationship, but it's a relatively new relationship, there's a certain kind of feng shui. If you've been together a very long time, there's yet another kind of feng shui. So it's really, really interesting stuff. And again, so much of it is common sense. But some of it's just charming, absolutely charming. So, and it has a lot to do with the elements, wind, water, you know, English major, not a scientist. I can't even remember what the earth, wind, and fire, that's it.
There you go. You got it.
Something like that. I don't know.
Well, why did you end up writing the book? I mean, you talked about developing it into the novel. What was the original inspiration?
It was just that Charlotte waking me up in the middle of the night saying, and I think, I really believe it's exactly why I probably invented DACA, was in spite of the, I have wonderful, wonderful parents and lived with my grandma, and we're all very, very close knit, but I needed a special friend. I needed that, you know, that thing my own size and my own age. And I was not the happiest camper at that time of my life when Charlotte materialized, just like DACA, and said, you know, take my hand here. Here's what we're going to do now. And I threw myself into it. I mean, it was one of those, like, you don't even need to eat and sleep. I was just so in that zone. And you know, I've got a divorce and, you know, all this stuff, life happens and whatever. And quandary about whether or not coming back to Wisconsin was the right thing. I knew it was the right thing. I mean, my folks are a little older, and my mom had broken her back. I'm an only child. You know, I mean, it's just the handwriting was on the wall, and they always supported me and did so much for me. So it just, you know, the time, I was there for 20 years, time to come home. But I was struggling with, you know, my 20 years, my friends, you know, my dear, dear girlfriends, the goddesses, you know, and so, you know, a couple of boyfriends and all that stuff. And once again, Charlotte said, you know, it's going to be okay. Let's work on this. Let's not overthink everything in your life. Let's focus on this. And it was such a great diversion. And it was, I got to live in this fantasy imaginary world for the months that I was writing it. It's a great escape. I got to tell you, writing, it's the best. People say, oh, going to the movies or whatever, but that's someone else's fantasy, that's someone else's escape. You know, you can create your own when you're writing.
I totally agree. Yes, it is a wonderful escape. Well, tell me a little bit about your writing process. Now, it sounds like inspiration became the motivation that got you going. But what kind of schedule did you keep, and how often did you write? What kinds of things like that?
Well, I would not, I would never advocate, kids, don't do this, don't try this at home. But when I'm in that zone, and I guess that's when the characters are alive inside of me or around me, I'm a little obsessive. Like, wake up at 3, 4 in the morning and just, you know, put the laptop on my lap and just write. I don't do anything. It's bad, actually, because I realize, holy God, I haven't been to the gym in a month, and, you know, I'm eating crap and drinking coffee all day. But in the times when I'm not doing, and that's when I wrote the short story, that's how it was for 6 days. I mean, it was probably like what tweakers, you know? I mean, I just couldn't stop. And the same thing, I kind of did the same thing when I was writing the novel. But subsequent to that, I blog for Huffington Post now, and I'm working on a couple other things and getting ready to, you know, really jump into a sequel. And now it's got to be discipline, because that muse is not there every single week when I have to turn my blogs in. You know what I mean? It's so I set. Plus, I'm the president of a photography coalition here in Milwaukee, and it's an unpaid position, but it's like 30, 40 hours a week. So there's so much. Yeah, there's a crazy amount of stuff to do and not enough hours in the day. So I do schedule time to write. Otherwise, that would end up kind of getting backburnered, which would be awful. But, yeah. And I, you know, the luxury to a large extent for me has, well, I do photography as well. So I don't have a day job. You know, I've got portrait clients and that kind of stuff. And you know, so if I had a 8-to-5 job or 9-to-5 job, I guess you just have to be disciplined. I guess I would just have to start, you know, write a couple hours before work. I'm kind of a morning writer. But yeah, for now, I like Thursdays are completely set aside just for blogging. Because I find if I don't do that, I, you know, we tend to procrastinate, or, and then all of a sudden, it's due, and I don't have an idea. So no matter, people get frustrated. They're like, come on, you can go to lunch, or come on, you can, you know, you'll be done by then. Let's just meet for a drink. I absolutely don't do anything on Thursdays. No lunches, no breakfast. I don't make plans for drinks in the evening, nothing. It's a 24-hour period where I just pretend I'm dead.
Well, good for you. I think that really speaks of self-discipline and commitment.
Well, you know, when unless you're a celebrity, a celebrity or a celebrity author, if you're a first-time author with any publisher, but particularly with a small publisher, you will do 99.9% of the marketing and the promotion of the book yourself. So there is, you know, you spent all the time and energy to write the book, and then in my case, I know it's a great idea because I got that validation from New Line. So, you know, I absolutely want the book to get out there. I want people to read it. So it would be foolish to have invested all of that and then just stick it in a drawer and go, well, if they buy it, they buy it. You know, I mean, you really have to, oh, it's that in and of itself is a full-time job. So, but you have to do it. But there's no
Well, what
That's
kinds
why I found
of things?
You.
There you go. Well, what kinds of
things
do you do?
Pardon me?
What kinds of things do you do to market the book?
Well, I look for any kind of radio show, podcasts, television interviews. Print media, I send out email after email after email. And, you know, you as you know, I mean, to be effective at that, you can't just ask someone for something without giving something. So there's a lot of research that goes into those emails before I ever send them out. I'm not just going to say, hey, you know, do me a favor and have me, you know, you ought to know who the person is that you're asking to talk with you and what are they interested in and what have they done and have you listened to the show?
Right.
Have you read the column? Have you, you know, I mean, and it's fun. I would 99% of the time because I really like meeting new people. So, and it gives me a lot of ideas, you know, when you read about what other people are doing and how they're doing it, it's like, oh, that's really cool, you know, and so you automatically have a rapport, I think, with someone when you've done your homework. And then, oh, my gosh, I do a lot of book signings. I go around to a lot of indie bookstores, tons of book clubs, tons of Skyping with book clubs all over the country. I have a street team, on and off street team, which is just people who've read the book, and they're all over the place, and they really, really like it. And so we email back and forth, and I send them postcards and flyers and bookmarks and all kinds of stuff and have little contests amongst ourselves, and I'll send them little feng shui kits and stuff. And what they do is they get out there, and they start spreading the word. If the book isn't carried in their local bookstore, they keep going in, and someday someone's going to get arrested. I just know it. Because I tell them, run in there, put the postcards all over and run, you know. and then the blogging for Huffington Post has helped quite a lot.
So, I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you have a website, yes?
I do. It's pamfurterbar.com.
And would you spell Furterbar?
Oh, sure. It's F like Frank, E-R, D-E-R, B like boy, A-R, fur, der, bar. And people could also just Google feng shui, which is F-E-N-G, shui is S-H-U-I, so feng shui and Charlotte Nightingale, and a bazillion things will pop up and they'll find me very easily.
So are you working on the sequel now?
In my head, I'm getting
mm-hmm.
ready to sit down and actually start putting some words, you know, typing into a keyboard. I know how it begins. I'm not exactly sure where it's going to go. She's going to have to tell me that. But I was going to say we, because Charlotte and I, we have decided that. But it's going to start off with quite a bang, and the biggest challenge of her life. So I'm excited about it, really excited about it.
Do you see a series evolving out of the Charlotte character?
I don't know. I never thought about that with the first one. And so many people said they wanted to know where does she go from there? You know, she finally kind of gets all better, then what? And I had to spend a lot of time really thinking about that and trying to conjure her and find out, you know, what's the next step in the journey here. And I don't want to reveal too much about it just because it really is quite a shocking beginning. But experiences that some of my very, very dear friends had that were so life changing and bone rattling kind of must have seeped into my psyche, because again, I woke up in the middle of the night and said, I know exactly where she has to start from this time. And now I just have to see what happens on this adventure. And I don't know if there's any going back to the well after this. I won't know until we've completed this part of the journey.
Sure. Well, is there anything autobiographical about Charlotte?
A girl with the worst luck in the world, David? Now, come on. Yeah, sure. Well, everything you write, you know that. It, to an extent, is autobiographical because it's formed by your life experience. I have always laughed at, I mean, not like a crazy person, but for the most part, sometimes there has to be a little distance between the thing and then the laughter, but I've laughed at my own misfortune because 9 times out of 10, I've brought it on myself, and it's funny. And when I was little, I was a chunky monkey, and all the other girls had bikinis, and I wanted one. I was about 10 years old, and my parents never wanted to tell me that they thought I was chunky, so they just said it. They thought it would be immodest, so I was not allowed to have one. And I thought, immodest? What planet are we living on? And I asked my grandma, the seamstress, to make me a bikini. And so we went to the fabric store, and we got a pattern, and she made me the two-piece. And I went to a local swimming pool. It was nothing fancy. We didn't have Speedos or anything. You just would wear, I was on a little swim team. And I went to a swim meet, and you get in the water to, get your body temperature acclimatized, whatever, and then, got up on the blocks, and, they fired the little pistol, and I dove in, and as my head came up, I heard this uproarious laughter, and I thought, oh, gosh, there's something really cold on my ass, and I the laughter and everything, and I realized, oh, Christ, the bottoms had come off. Grandma didn't know there was such a thing, as swimsuit elastic. And now at my age, now I would be like, whatever. Right? Stuff happens.
Yeah, right.
At that age where the whole world, you feel like a billion people, eyes are on you, I could. And then, what do I do? The swimsuit's like halfway across the pool, back right where I dove in. And I'm in the car on the way home. But my dad started laughing, and my mom was trying not to laugh, and I just couldn't help it. And I knew then and there, this is a story. So
that's
Charlotte,
because
Charlotte bottom
right there.
Yeah. Oh, I've got tons of them. I do a little essay series for Wisconsin Public Radio, and real life, it beats fiction any day of the year. But so, that's where Charlotte comes from, is that kind of stuff. There's
Well, how do you deal with adversity?
Oh, well, sometimes better than others. On a good day, I laugh. I try to find the humor in it because for me, it's important to remove myself from the drama of that moment, because no good ever comes from being in the eye of the cyclone, It's just there's stuff swirling all around you, and it's just too easy to, get yourself all caught up. So I try to sort of remove myself. And once I do, and I mean, this is a sick thing, but I think, well, what if this shit was happening to my worst enemy? And then you got to laugh. And then you realize yourself, but by then, you kind of, it's perspective. And as long as nobody's dying, or terribly injured, or, I'm not a jerk, but most of the time these things that we just think are, such terrible adversity turn out to really oftentimes be an opportunity, and it's just so rare that it's as bad as you think it is.
That's
and
right.
Again, I like to say that is my story, and I'm sticking to it, David.
That sounds like my line. You stole that from me.
Well, you gave me DACA and now everything, you know.
Yeah. I once had a life coach who said that the only thing there are out there are opportunities. And there, you know, there are no mistakes. Everything is an opportunity for learning and growing. And, you know, that's essentially what you're saying, as I hear it.
Yeah, it's only you've articulated it much, much, much better. But, yeah, that's, you know, it's just, I think it's hard, as I said, you know, it. Our good selves, our rational selves, the selves that love ourselves, know that to be true, what you just said. We all know that. But, man, when you're in the thick of it sometimes, it's really hard to step back and say, oh, this is an opportunity. Right?
Right. Right. Yeah. 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 It is a supreme challenge.
Mm-hmm. That's life, though, right?
It is. It is. And it is what it is. You know, there's no changing that.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, you know, the challenge is to try to be objective and detached, and as you say, not give in to the drama and the situation, and to see where the aha moments are, what the learning opportunities are, and just go with the flow.
Yeah, it sounds so simple, and because it makes perfect sense, but again, now as you were saying that, I was just thinking back to like the last couple weeks, and you know, so much of my life has been, I don't want to say like solitary. I have, you know, I've had wonderful, wonderful friends. And I mean, you know, writing is a very solitary occupation. And, you know, so I have my characters to play with, but they couldn't do too much to piss me off because I control them. But now that I'm with this nonprofit and I'm out there all the time, and it's, you know, a volunteer situation, and it's so many different personalities. It is a challenge to, number one, just try to be chill, but also to try to see the opportunities in some of these situations.
Right.
So I got to start. I'm just as you, this has been like spending time with a therapist, David. This is super. I'm just thinking I've got it. I've got some work to do now.
Well, don't we all? We're all works in progress, that's for sure. Let's delve a little bit into the spiritual aspect of your book, because it definitely has that, and I think anything related to humor is spiritual. I like to believe that God has a tremendous sense of humor and that it's up for us to try to find that humor in our lives and maintain consistent moments of joy, as Esther Hicks would say. What kind of spiritual messages do you find that there are in your book or themes?
Well, for me, the I'm a very spiritual being, but a complete atheist. So I believe, but that isn't to say that there isn't something inside of us, something that's greater than us. It's hard, and again, I'm not going to articulate this very well, I'm sure, but I think that in the book, the character of Charlotte is anybody who's lost their way, who's lost their, it could be faith, you know, it could be a religious faith, it could be simply a spiritual thing, but she's, or just self-confidence. And I know that people that believe in a higher being believe the same thing that I do, I guess, which is this, whatever that self is, that self-confidence has to be nurtured and fed, and it's the best part of us. Now, whether or not you believe that that comes from God, and that's how we honor a God, or you just believe that we have such a short time here on this planet, we need to honor that thing that's within us just for ourselves, That's where Charlotte has fallen down on the job and comes from a family that's not treated her particularly well. They never fostered that idea that she should love herself. They taught her sister that, the golden child, but she was kind of cast adrift. And so it's the story of someone trying to find that essence. And you can call it self-confidence, chutzpah, whatever, but that is her journey, is to find that good thing, that light inside of her. And Quan, who is a very, very spiritual being and the feng shui master, and he's just very gentle, and there's almost, he's almost luminous because he's in touch with the light that's inside of him. Him showing her kindness is like him sort of showing a lantern somehow that she can follow a little bit to finding what's inside of her. So, and then the humor, that's just a slam dunk for me. I mean, I can't imagine it any other way than the ability to laugh at yourself when things are really, really, really bad is, and I will use the term, a godsend. I like to think of it as a spiritual book, and you know, it's my kind of spiritual, I guess. It doesn't denigrate, you know, it's not mean-spirited at all. It's a very positive thing. It's just not directed toward a god.
Well, it sounds like there are life lessons contained in the book.
I think so. I mean,
it sounds like
it's
filled with them.
She taught me an awful lot. Pardon?
It sounds like it's filled with them.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, and yet, and so, some of it's very, very broad humor. But again, when people read between the lines, they actually find some poignancy there, which I just love. I like going to the book signings and all that, but, you know, that's like a sales job because people haven't read the book yet and you want everyone to buy the book. I love book clubs because it's a room full of people that have read the book that find things that I wasn't even aware, messages that I wasn't aware were there. I mean, on a subconscious level, I'm sure I was. But it's so validating and enjoyable from when I hear people saying it changed things for them. Oh, man, how cool is that?
Oh, yeah. That's amazing. Well, it's said that everybody has a book in them, and there are an awful lot of people out there that want to write books. I have people telling me that all the time. What kind of suggestions would you make to somebody that has that desire but has no idea how to go about it?
Read. I believe that whatever you enjoy reading the most is the genre in which you're best suited to write. So, yeah, I like reading dramatic novels and dramatic fiction and actually quite a bit of biographies, but I'm totally drawn to well-written humor. That is my absolute favorite. Funny movies, funny books, and you know, funny commercials, funny TV shows, funny everything. So, and my friends are all pretty funny. So I guess I would just say, you know, read as much as a person could in that genre. And I tend to think we learn a lot of stuff by osmosis. And again, there are probably tremendous creative writing teachers who would want to bitch slap me for saying this, but I think that if you try to dissect why the stuff that you like reading so much works and try to figure out what the formula is and how you might do that yourself, you'll kind of lose your spontaneity and your kind of creative thread there. Look, if you're literate, you ought to be able to tell a story. And for anyone who believes they have a story inside of them, that's half the battle. And people say, I'm sure, same thing with you. People say, oh, have I got a story for you? You should write my story. No, you should write your story. I got my own stories to write, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, what would you suggest? Like, people maybe just starting, just put 15 minutes a day aside. You know, no phones, no husband, no wife, no boyfriend, no girlfriend, no dogs, no cats, no nothing. 15 minutes. Come on, we can all spare 15 minutes. Even if you're in the bathtub, you lock yourself in the bathroom, whatever, and just write. Just write.
I agree.
Start telling a story. Yeah.
You need to make it a priority, though, in order to make it happen. It's one thing to have the desire, but unless you do develop a little bit of discipline and set some time aside, it's not going to happen.
No, but that's what separates the men from the boys, isn't it?
Right.
If you want it badly enough, you'll
right.
make it happen.
That's right. Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, we do have a caller. Would you like to take a call?
Oh, I would love to.
Okay, this is Diana.
Hi, Diana.
Hi. I tuned in late, so I don't know. You sound familiar. Have you been on the show before?
No, I have not.
I hope
they invite me back, though, sometime.
Well, yeah, you're doing very good. This is your first show?
I've done a couple of things like this, but it's still all pretty new to me.
Isn't she doing great?
Well, of course, yeah. And she
well,
sounds
David
very
makes
young.
It seem easy. Jeez.
Yeah.
So how
he
are
does.
You, Diana?
I feel comfortable. I'm good. I'm just enjoying listening. I don't have any questions.
Oh, great. Do you write?
You. How long did it take you to get your first book done, or your book done?
Well. It was, you know, I could say 20 years because, or not 20 years, but the short story, yeah, you know, an overnight success in just 20 short years. The short story I wrote in like 6 days, and then a couple more weeks after that, and I expanded it a little bit, and then it just sat in a drawer for 15 years. And then I spent about, yep. So, I'm sorry, honey, go ahead.
Well, that's basically where mine is, and drafts here and there. Drafts and blogs. You know, drafts are where you can hide what you've written.
Right. Well, so now do you dust, have you taken it out and dusted it off and gotten back to work on it?
Well, not really, because I'm living on the road and I have no equipment or anywhere to do the work that I have to do.
So it'll
just stay there. Yeah.
Well, you know what?
I lost a lot of papers and everything, too. Things are just going to have to channel through me, too, for it to come back when I get to wherever it is I'm going.
Well, and you can write about that. You know? I mean, it sounds like it's quite a journey.
Well, yeah. That is what the first book is about, the first journey. 11-11. Getting kind of late for that. But it's all going to work out, and I'm not worried about it. I'm not obsessed about it. I was just wondering, okay, so you had yours on hold for 20 years. What did you just keep changing it, or what did you do?
No, I it just went into a drawer, and I moved on to other things. You know, I was frustrated that the movie deal fell apart and, you know, that left a bit of a bitter taste. So I just, you know, I said the hell with it. And I had to make a living, you know, so I went back to directing commercials and just doing other stuff. I started writing screenplays. And then, you know, when I came back to it, the planets lined up, I guess, in a way, right? You just know when the time is right.
Your time was right. That was it.
Yep, exactly.
And you came back to finish it. Well, you're already a writer, writing plays and things like that. It had to come the second when you decided to bring it out. It was time, and you were able to do it. So, So if you haven't already, if I was probably napping when you said where your books are, you want to say it again?
Oh, sure.
How to get a copy of your book.
On Amazon. You can go to Amazon.com. It's in a lot of little independent bookstores. Amazon.com is probably the easiest way.
Yeah. And you have your bookstores too already? Good.
Yep. I think it's at Barnes & Noble. I know it's at BarnesandNoble.com. And then the Independent Bookstores of America, something like that. But, Yeah, it's always fun when it's in the bookstore, but I know a lot of people really like to read electronic versions of the book. So Amazon has the hardcover, they've got the paperback, and they've got the e-book as well. So.
Well, I still like to read books, but I don't hang on to them. I pass them on.
That's a nice thing to do.
I just enjoy them while I have them, and then I'm passing forward. I read a really funny one. I read it all in one day.
What is it?
One of the psychics was talking about a time in his life when he was obeying the voices he heard. He jumped in front of a car.
Oh dear.
And he survived. But it's like, to me, it was so hysterical. But he survived, you know, and he passed his psych exam, and he survived, but the person who he jumped in front of was the one who was damaged and traumatized.
Well, you certainly have an interesting sense of humor, woman.
Yes.
I won't say his name because I didn't tell him I was going to tell about his book. But I did pass it forward, and I imagine it'll keep going around because I just thought it was so funny. But he did a good job. He had all of the data that happened at every emergency room visit, every doctor visit, you know, just to prove that this was really a real story. So you could see all the real data, and then his talking, because he could hear people's voices, and he had to try to curb it because he could hear what people were thinking and what they were thinking about him. And his whole life was funny as he was growing into his psychichood. But now I think he's pretty balanced now. So his name is Wimmer. He throws stones. He reads the stones. So if you ever have a chance to get a reading from him, you should do that. Just know that he wrote a very funny book.
What's his name, Diana?
Yeah.
His name is Wimmer, Gary Wimmer. He was on Psychics Gone Wild. He might have his own show now.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure. Because I don't have internet now, so I'm not sure. But he probably does have his own show.
Oh, I'd love to have. I like
the stone throwing. I like anything that's sort of Native American heritage, you know.
Mm-hmm. And he does a good reading. He does a good reading just by throwing stones.
Cool.
So your book is mostly your life story, then. Which would be very interesting.
Sorry, I'm at a Walmart.
Oh.
Here comes.
Diana, we're going to wrap things up. Thank you for calling in. I'm just going to have a few parting words with Pam, and then we're going to call it a night. But thank you so much for contributing to the show.
Nice meeting you,
okay.
Diana. Thanks for calling. Bye.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, Pam, do you have any parting words of wisdom that you'd like to share?
Laugh. Laugh often, laugh loud, laugh first.
I love it. There's nothing better to do. It's true what the Reader's Digest says. Laughter is the best medicine. Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight, and best wishes with your book and with writing the sequel to it.
Thank you so much, and thank you for this. This has been absolutely lovely, and now what I have to do is start writing the story of DACA.
That's right. Absolutely. You've got the You've got the seed. Now you just need to water it and watch it grow.
That's right. Thank you for that.
Okay, you're welcome. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize. Good night, and God bless.